Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Not only am I making puzzles for a puzzler for a customer who has these set out in front of them trying to figure it out, but it's also a puzzle for me as well, trying to figure out how to make it so that it works.
Welcome back to Working. I'm your host, June Thomas.
And I'm your other host, Karen Hahn.
Karen, it's so nice to see you again and to be talking about one of your interviews. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm good. It's kind of cooling down in Brooklyn, which I am very grateful for. And this is my last week in town, so that's good.
I can't believe it.
I know. I'm trying to have one last meal at all of my favorite restaurants and stuff like that.
Yeah, for sure.
And whose voice did we hear at the top of the show?
That was Lynn Aximid, the puzzle designer for Liberty Puzzles.
Puzzles like in jigsaw puzzles?
Yes, indeed.
Well, I'm guessing that if you wanted to speak to him, there's something special about these puzzles. Tell me more about Linen's work.
Yeah, so I'm obsessed with Liberty Puzzles, and there's a few things that make their work really special, in my opinion. The first thing is that they're woodcut puzzles, so all the pieces are like pretty thick and have a really nice heft. And the second thing is that the puzzle piece shapes are really, really unique. They're not like the typical like square with little round bits either right. off of them or on them that we're used to. Instead, the pieces can take the forms of like trees, animals, snowflakes, squiggly lines, just anything. And they're really art in and of themselves, besides the art that's on the actual puzzle.
And I did have a quick look on their website and I saw that they also kind of, the pieces also sometimes like have their own thing going on almost.
Yeah, it's really, really remarkable. Like some of the puzzles have almost like what I think you would call like Easter eggs. Like one of the puzzles that I own from Liberty Puzzles, you can take the pieces in that puzzle and then turn them into a little 3D dinosaur. Like you can make a different like mini puzzle.
Get out of town. That's crazy. And I'm guessing that you also asked Lynn some questions that are intended exclusively for Slate Plus members. What will they hear?
Yeah, so in our conversation, Lennon notes that he sort of fell into puzzle designing. So for the Slate Plus segment, we talk about how he finds time for and balances his personal projects and art with the art that he does for Liberty Puzzles.
That is obviously going to be fascinating. So if for some unfathomable reason you aren't yet a member of Slate Plus, why don't you sign up today? You will get extra segments on shows like Working, Culture Gabfest, The Waves. Some shows like Slow Burn and Big Mood, Little Mood have extra episodes just for members. And you will never hit a paywall on the Slate site. If you would like to learn more about joining Slate Plus, just go to slate.com/workingplus. All right, now let's listen in on Karen's conversation with Lynn Aximid.
Hi, Lynn, thank you so much for coming on the Working Podcast. I'm so excited to talk with you.
I'm delighted to be here.
I'm a huge fan of Liberty Puzzles and the work that you do. So I wanted to start off, I guess, kind of pretty broadly. One of the things that I love about Liberty Puzzles is the beautiful pieces of artwork that you guys use with each of the puzzles. And I'm curious, where does a puzzle begin? How do you choose what pieces of art can or will become a puzzle?
We have a sort of a committee that is always looking around for new artwork, just kind of scouring the web, looking through books, calendars, kind of wherever we can. And we also have customers that will send us emails with their own work or with work from people that they know.
Oh, wow.
Artists that they know. Yeah. So we're constantly getting a steady stream, it seems like. And then with a committee, we all kind of decide, you know, based on just kind of parameters of what we think will make a good puzzle in terms of visually, mm-hmm. patterns, themes. We basically make our decisions kind of from there.
And as a designer and as one of the people kind of looking for the perfect piece, is there one thing above all else that you personally sort of love to consider or find most important?
We kind of look at ourselves sort of as curators.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing that we ask ourselves is, what does this image say?
Mm-hmm.
And then how do we want to develop this? How do we want to add to what is already going on with the artwork, what the artist is trying to say?
Mm-hmm.
Usually then I will be the one who will take the image and then start brainstorming ideas as to how to make this a puzzle that people are going to want to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes really great artwork that classically fits into a realm of popular or is historically considered a masterpiece, mm-hmm. might not always make the best puzzle. Mm-hmm. It might not be something that everyone would want to put together. If there's a lot of dark colors or subject matter that maybe gets a little too dark, it's a little risky. And that's not to say we don't go down that road,
mm-hmm.
but sometimes it sways the decision-making, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
So from there, I think about what the image, again, is saying, what it's communicating,
mm-hmm.
doing a little bit of research into who the artist is,
mm-hmm.
what they were trying to say, if there's any kind of information on that. And then I'm a huge fan of writing lists, so I just start writing everything down that comes into my head. And then I start drawing. I just go directly to my sketchbook and I start sketching out whatever ideas are coming into my head.
And I read on the website, and you touched on this a little bit as well, that the design process sort of starts as you hand draw. And it sounds like you sort of start with maybe piece ideas or kind of more specific, smaller images rather than necessarily like having the outline of whatever art piece you're looking at and then trying to fill it in from there. Is that right?
Exactly. I'll take a theme, say it's a Colorado themed puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
First, I'll be thinking of all the obvious stuff, but then I might be thinking of whimsy characters that I want to expand upon, mm-hmm. perhaps. So I guess to kind of back things up a little bit, a whimsy piece,
mm-hmm.
is a term that we didn't create that term.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was a term to describe the whimsical nature of the silhouette pieces originally cut by hand cutters in the early 1900s, 1930s, there was sort of a jigsaw puzzle boom during that, mm-hmm. time. And that was the inspiration to do what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And we've carried on the term whimsy to describe all these little special shapes cut, mm-hmm. out of quarter-inch plywood that you put together. And it's not a puzzle that only contains the whimsies. There's,
right.
a bunch of other pieces interconnecting them as well. And so kind of with that idea, somewhere along the line, I started trying to make more complex scenarios between those specific pieces, the whimsy pieces, so that say, a cowboy on a horse, for instance, mm-hmm. would be several pieces coming together to make a scene.
Yeah.
Maybe it's running, maybe it's bucking in the air, and kind of focusing on expressions as much as I can in a tiny silhouette. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of been the fun mm-hmm. in creating something like this. It's using the puzzle as a medium to communicate whatever I can, you know, anything that is possible to communicate with just some puzzle pieces. So as the puzzler is putting them together, it sort of becomes like a conversation between the design mm-hmm. and the person interacting with it. Mm-hmm. And then also the other dimension being the image.
Sort of on that note, so you mentioned, like, again, in the process of finding artwork, like being able to look at a piece of art and then thinking about how you can add to it, or I guess sort of be in conversation with it, which I think on the surface sounds pretty abstract. So I'm wondering if you could tell us maybe a little bit more in detail about that process, whether it's kind of knowing what shapes would complement it or, yeah, I have no other examples because I have no idea how it works.
So it could be as simple as I have an image that is by, say, a Brazilian artist, and it looks like a little hamlet mm-hmm. with sort of a tropical scene going on there. But I may not know, or the puzzler may not know, the customer may not know anything about it, anything mm-hmm. about the image. Maybe they just like the way it looks. They like the colors in it. But I will do just enough research at the very minimum to find out where it's at, so I know what type of animals might be in that scene. Mm-hmm. If it's an Amazon rainforest, maybe there's some jaguars, some capybaras, other animals that you may see, or I may look into who the artist was and then do maybe a little portrait as a whimsy piece of that artist mm-hmm. or a little detail about their life. I've done that a few times, or a little detail about the historical period that they're in. And that's another dimension that is super fun for me.
Yeah.
To just kind of look into the history behind whatever this image is, whatever mm-hmm. the theme is. And so I'll just kind of expand upon it. And I'll do that in a way that I would like to say adds either a seriousness to it or something funny. Mm-hmm. to whatever the characters or the animals are, put them in kind of formations that may be kind of weird, messing with the puzzler so that the animals are upside down or, you know, turned in ways, or, you know, depending on how devious I'm feeling, I think is really what it comes down to.
It is really kind of refreshing to hear you talk about this medium as something that is kind of so considered and so artistic, I guess, to put it very simply, because it sounds a lot like your process is about figuring out kind of your own mode of storytelling within this, as opposed to, I feel like, a lot of mass-produced puzzles just like hitting the marks of like 500 pieces or 1,000 pieces, which Liberty Puzzles doesn't do. Like, it, there's no kind of set number that there has to be. But I'm curious, regardless, if there is any consideration of like the number of pieces, or I guess sort of difficulty of a puzzle when you're putting it together. Because even so, like on the website, when you're looking through the different puzzles that are on offer, it's still, you can still sort them from like small to large to extra large.
Right. So at some point we decided to standardize our aesthetic in a way where mm-hmm. generally we want the pieces to be a certain size and mm-hmm. to sort of engineer them in a way that would just be consistent, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But kind of knowing the difficulty level with them would be with little tricks that we would include. The image itself, kind of going back to image selection, there are mm-hmm. certain images where, because there's a large area full of a solid color, for instance,
mm-hmm.
and if the person knows what that image is beforehand,
mm-hmm.
they will know all the sky pieces go in the sky.
Yeah.
But if there's a lot of pattern everywhere and broken color, that adds to a difficulty. Similarities of cut styles will also add to the difficulty. But I think pretty early on, we decided we wanted to have just kind of a consistent aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to say like some of them will range on a slightly smaller piece size. And then we have made some puzzles that are a larger piece puzzle mm-hmm. and a kid size piece puzzle. But for the most part, we kind of stick with this kind of standard adult size or, mm-hmm. yeah.
And this is another sort of technical question as well, but one of the things, again, that sets Liberty Puzzles apart is its use of the quarter-inch plywood for its pieces. It's just such a nice kind of tangible thing. It's such a nice texture, and especially putting it together, it's so nice. But I'm curious how much of a bearing that has on what shapes you can or can't do, or if it affects the design process at all.
Yeah, it definitely does. It's mm-hmm. always something I have to keep in mind. I really like the challenge of it in a way. There's times when I become frustrated. It's kind of, not only am I making puzzles for a puzzler, for a customer who's
right.
who has these set out in front of them trying to figure it out, but it's also a puzzle for me as well, trying to figure out how to make it so that it works.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, I've been all over the place trying different things. And again, the fun of it is having those parameters that I have to design within and trying to figure out ways to break the rules in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Lately, I kind of go back and forth between skinny pieces versus not so skinny or not so thin.
Mm-hmm.
As so they don't break.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a rule that I keep pushing that boundary, kind of testing the limit. And if I do that consistently throughout a puzzle, stylistically and aesthetically, it's going to hold together, which to me, I like to see that. But it's also, it serves as a function in making it difficult for someone putting it together.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a repetition and pattern of edges, or I guess what I'm thinking of specifically
mm-hmm.
is a puzzle that I made. It's not the only example of this,
mm-hmm.
but I made a dinosaur puzzle called Chasing Butterflies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all based on this idea about the end of the Cretaceous period and the asteroid impact that wiped out the dinosaurs, right? Well, yeah. So in that, I have a bunch of dinosaur pieces. There's a bunch of bones, and there's a bunch of,
yeah.
there's like teeth, and then there's, you know, the spiky ridges of the back of a dinosaur, for instance, mm-hmm. and kind of knowing how far I can push the boundaries with those edges,
yeah,
without those pieces breaking, is really, it's a fine line to kind of dance on.
Yeah.
We'll be back with more of Karen's conversation with Lynn and Aksumit after this.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Listeners, I hope that you've been enjoying Working Overtime, the bi-weekly bonus version focused on listener questions that we launched back at the beginning of this year. We love to give advice, who doesn't? And we want to answer your questions, respond to your concerns, and generally share ideas on that show. Is there a creative problem you're having or a creative practice that's working well for you right now? Well, drop us a line at working@slate.com or call us, we extra love voicemails, at 304-933-WORK. You can also record a voice memo on your phone and send that to us in an email. And if you're enjoying this episode, don't forget to subscribe to Working wherever you get your podcasts. Now back to Karen's conversation with Linen Aksumit.
I'm delighted that you brought up Chasing Butterflies because it's one of the handful of Liberty puzzles that I have and one that I love a lot, in particular because of the designs that you put in there, but also because you're able to take some of those pieces and turn them into little 3D models of dinosaurs. I'm curious where that idea came from because it's so brilliant and so fun.
Thanks. Yeah. That idea, I started playing around with the idea of creating 3D pieces several years ago, and then I would include them just kind of scattered throughout puzzles as an extra additional challenge, extra credit for the customer to put together if they want, but not necessarily thinking like, oh, I'm going to advertise this to all the customers, I kind of specifically kept it hidden and then just kept expanding on the idea because it was just so fun for me to create and wrapping my head around just making a 3D, basically a little 3D sculpture that happened to also be in the form of a puzzle that you would just put together 3D. And I mean, really, like, I kind of saw some of the other, there's examples out there of 3D models that are made out of balsa wood and stuff like that. There's a lot of that stuff that just would never work in a puzzle, but it's really kind of fun to consider what if. Or think about another way to do it so that it works in both ways. So that, you know, maybe it's a kind of weird looking piece, but maybe this weird looking piece and this weird looking piece go together in a way that makes sense with what's going on in the image too. And just kind of thinking that is sort of a conversation that I'm having with the design of whatever I'm making and the person putting it together.
And you sort of talked about this a little bit, but I'm curious, you mentioned that you've been with Liberty Puzzles basically since the beginning, but I'm curious if between that point to now, how much you can tell that your process has developed or grown or changed and what I guess you feel you've kind of learned or maybe gotten better at in that time?
I think it's changed quite a bit. And I've always kind of thought of the whimsy, kind of going back to this idea of what these special pieces are. I've kind of gone back to that idea from time to time, but at one point I really sort of looked at it as a cartoon in a way, mm-hmm. like this kind of lighthearted, funny, kind of goofy, I guess whimsical is the best term for it. Mm-hmm. And so I had this very cartoony style with exaggerated facial expressions of any of the characters that I did, very rounded edges, sort of noodle-like arms, mm-hmm. like very inspired by old cartoons, old animation. And it was kind of reflective of the time for me, the art that I was looking at, that I was mm-hmm. that I was surrounding myself with, and over time kind of getting feedback on that, and then at mm-hmm. a certain point kind of wanting to do more and wanting to shed my skin a little bit of what I was doing there, mm-hmm. and also kind of with the attitude of it, I got more and more serious, I think, professionally about what I was doing mm-hmm. and where I thought this could go and the type of things I wanted to say, just with the pieces in general, how they would link to, again, to the subject matter of whatever the images would be. And I guess I've kind of done it in a way where I don't really go back to the old style anymore mm-hmm. for any of the pieces. Instead, I would just make new ones. I would draw new stuff. And sometimes in doing that, I'll revisit concepts that I've done before, or characters or expressions. Mm-hmm. And then I'll kind of occasionally redraw them and try to communicate it in different ways.
Mm-hmm. So how long have you been with Liberty Puzzles now?
I started in 2006, and they had been around for about a year and a half before mm-hmm. that. So it was really early on. There was basically just the two owners. Mm-hmm. And we all kind of did everything in those early days. Mm-hmm. So we were all wearing multiple hats, doing a bunch of things. And little by little, I think starting like within a few months, I started designing more on a full-time basis, mm-hmm. I would say.
On a more, I guess, macro level, when did you first become interested in designing puzzles? How did you start off in that field?
I didn't know it was a field, honestly. I went to art school and specialized in illustration. Mm-hmm. And I just always have loved drawing and painting and art in general, just the art field. And I found this company, and what they were doing, I had never heard of before. Mm-hmm. But it sounded amazing. So it just all clicked. It all made sense. All the pieces came together.
And because puzzle designing is a field that obviously I'm not familiar with, is there an equivalent to, I guess, writer's block is the most common term for it, or a creative stall? Does it happen to you? And then what do you try to do to work through it or around it?
Yes, that's a great question. I am a big proponent of just showing up some days mm-hmm. and just sitting down and starting doing anything, just putting my pencil to paper, whatever the project is, whatever the puzzle is that I'm working on. I'll try to just start writing stuff down, and I'll start making lists of whatever comes into my head that relates to it. And most of the time, I'm not creating every piece brand new for every puzzle. I'll mm-hmm. probably create like 4 to 5 on average new ones to go in. And then I will use stuff that I've already used for mm-hmm. other puzzles to kind of speed through the process. So unless I have a larger chunk of time, and if it's a image that I really care about, that I just really find fascinating mm-hmm. and really want to do a deep dive, I'll take a little bit more time and I'll create a bunch, if not all, brand new pieces.
Wow.
Sometimes what's really frustrating is it'll look great on paper, and then I translate it to digital form mm-hmm. where I'll do basically the digital drawing of it, and it just won't look right. It mm. won't, I know it's not going to function correctly. Mm-hmm. In which case I say to myself, is it worth trying to fix this to make it work? Mm-hmm. Or should I just scrap it and start over again? And if I do that, do I have enough time to do that? But it's the added challenge, I guess, of being a creative person to kind of believe in what ideas you set forth for yourself in accomplishing. Mm-hmm. And then also seeing it as you're creating it, being able to work and manipulate that idea in a way that makes sense, in a way that where it's all going to work. Mm-hmm. And then I guess pushing and pulling on it until that can happen, or learning from that and just moving on to the next one, or starting over from scratch again. And it's kind of cool, you know, thinking about it that way. There's a certain amount of luck sometimes mm-hmm. where if you just show up and you just start putting in the work, sometimes the magic will happen. Sometimes it could all just be in my head and it just feels good and it just makes sense. And I'm really flowing with what is there. And if it's not, just really still being open to exploring where I can go, where I can take it. Usually that probably involves stepping away from it for a while and then coming back.
Yeah. And as a final question, for any listeners who might not have heard of Liberty Puzzles before, but now are raring to go get one for themselves, do you have a favorite puzzle of yours that you've worked on that you would recommend?
There are a bunch that I really had a lot of fun with. Mm-hmm. And the Oregon Trail was a lot of fun, and that was mm-hmm. a recent one. And if you're at all interested in a 1001 Arabian Nights, that was also a project that I mm-hmm. thought was really interesting. And I'd say go onto the website on mm-hmm. Liberty Puzzles and look at the newest spring 2022 selection. There's a lot of good stuff in there. And I would say just kind of in general, as puzzles go, I always like my most recent work. to refer people to my most recent work. And if I'm looking back, I'm always the most happy with my recent work, or I try to be. And so I would start there. Mm-hmm. Chasing Butterflies, also, you brought that up earlier, is also one that I had a lot of fun with.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so, so much again for taking the time to talk with us. It's been a real delight.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget. giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you, fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Karen, that was fascinating. I was completely ignorant of this kind of, I guess, meta puzzle before. Mm-hmm. You obviously know and enjoy them. I have two questions about that. Have you always been a jigsaw puzzle person? And how did you discover Liberty puzzles?
So in answer to your first question, I would say that I haven't always made time to do jigsaw puzzles, but I have always enjoyed putting them together. So in that sense, I would say that I've always been a jigsaw puzzle person. As for Liberty puzzles, I remember the very first Liberty puzzle that I bought was meant to be a birthday present for my boyfriend. I think we were like maybe at least half a year, a little more than that, into the pandemic. And a pandemic activity that we'd been doing was jigsaw puzzles. And I think I sort of Googled like, ooh, like what's like the nicest jigsaw puzzle that I could buy for somebody. And this obviously popped up because they're so, so unique and like really, really just wonderful. So I got one of those. We put it together after we received it, and we loved it so much that we've bought a new puzzle or two if we're feeling really extravagant from Liberty Puzzles every year after that.
I love the idea of Googling next level jigsaw puzzles, you know, like actually getting a result that makes you happy.
Yeah.
So this may seem like a really banal question, but I'm super curious because this has gotten in the way of my exploring puzzles. Literally, where do you do them? Do you have like a dedicated puzzle table? As we've established in previous episodes, both of us were only children. Mm-hmm. And I kind of associate jigsaw puzzles with only children for whatever reason. And I know that as a kid, I certainly had a lot of alone time, but I was never a jigsaw person because our house, just to be frank, was always a bit messy. And there were no available surfaces where I could have tried to put it together. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I then replicated that in my own home. And that's a real hurdle on taking on what sounds like an amazingly fun and challenging activity, but one that you kind of, it's not going to be done in an hour. So what do you do? And do you have any suggestions for people who do not have a lot of space?
I have to agree that it is very hard to find a dedicated space to do puzzles because it's not only having the space to put the puzzle together, but then the space to put all the pieces that you haven't put together yet.
Yes, yes.
That said, in our current place, my partner and I do puzzles on our dining table because we eat at our coffee table. So it's less that we dedicated a space to doing puzzles and more that that was kind of the biggest flat surface that we have that sees the least traffic.
Yeah.
And if you're really trying to, I guess, find a space to do puzzles, figure out where you would want to do the puzzle apart from what space is cleanest right now. Just think about which surface would be best for doing a puzzle on and then figure out if you can clean that off at least temporarily.
That is a fantastic piece of advice. I was recently listening to something who gave just a random piece of advice that was, you know, imagine how you would solve a problem if you could not fail. Like if there was no problem, like, you know, and like, okay, space is no problem. Where would I like to do this? That's a great way of approaching it. I also have to share something that just today I was watching a YouTube video in which a very hip self-help dude was extolling the benefits of jigsaw puzzles. Like he said, if you're doing something with your hands while you, say, listen to an audiobook, the content of that book stays with you better. That's what he claimed anyway. But he began the segment by showing a table with a puzzle in progress. And he admitted that when his friends come over, they almost always say, hey, is your grandma visiting? You know, maybe in a tone and maybe not, but just what I'm trying to say is that puzzles are kind of associated with the unhip, with kind of old-fashioned ways of spending time. And obviously, that's nonsense for the kind of puzzles that Liberty makes, or just maybe generally. And I'm just kind of thinking about other conversations that you and I have had about, say, cartoons or anime, and I'll be all like, oh, they're for kids, aren't they? And I guess basically what I'm saying is we really get hung up on like what it means that we associate art with a certain age group. And in short, isn't that bananas?
Yeah, I totally agree. It's totally bananas because it's ultimately reductive and also closes you off to so much media, whether it's cartoons or puzzles.
Yeah.
That said, I have to say, I'm not sure I agree with that self-help guy because I love throwing on TV shows that I don't totally care about or know that won't really require me to puzzle things together when I'm doing puzzles, specifically because I know I'm not going to process everything that happens in the show while I'm doing the puzzle.
Yeah, now I wish I was more of a puzzler so I could weigh in on how they affect me. I absolutely loved the way that Linen talked about difficulty. You know, if you're a puzzle maker or you're designing a crossword or writing trivia questions, there's this added element of trying to figure out the most desirable degree of difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say how hard you want a puzzle of the kind that Linen makes to be? Is it about how many hours it'll take? Is it about wanting to figure out something new? How do you know when it is going to be just hard enough for what you're looking for?
So I think I tend to think of difficulty with jigsaw puzzles in terms of piece number, which is a little reductive because like colors in the piece will affect the difficulty a lot too. But I'd say I'd usually looking for at least 500 pieces. And with a Liberty puzzle, it'll usually take me about a week with anywhere between like 30 minutes to a couple hours devoted to it every day.
Wow.
And so it's less about how hard it is for me than having like a nice activity to do that you can share with someone else. And also like the serotonin boost is like so immediate when you get a piece right. There's only been one jigsaw puzzle that I've ever walked away from, which is not a Liberty puzzle, but it was like a 1,000-piece puzzle of a painting of Wrigley Field. And there were so many patches that were like just one color or like minuscule crown detail that I could just not finish it.
No.
And so that I did not finish. That said, I'm curious. I know you said you're not a big puzzler, but do you like for puzzles to be difficult? And what is your approach to them?
I would say, so no, I don't do jigsaw puzzles. But I think, for example, with crossword puzzles, I really like the way that, for example, in the New York Times, depending on what day it is, you know how hard it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's that knowing that actually is what I enjoy. Like, I like knowing that on Monday, yeah, I'm going to be able to do it in 5 minutes and I'm going to feel like a superhero. And then I'll realize, oh yeah, probably a child could do it in 5 minutes too. When I'm in Britain, there's this terribly lowbrow magazine that I love to get. It's called Take a Break. And it's got just awful, as told to, terrible things happen to me stories. But it also has a lot of puzzles and you can win money. And you would think that the puzzle that you can win £1,000 for is going to be harder than the one that gives you £50. And it's not always the case, and it drives me crazy. Why do you make the hard ones be like just a £50 check when I could go all the way to like a holiday in Turkey for, you know, just doing a dumb thing that literally took me 30 seconds?
Yeah.
I also really enjoyed what he said about getting better at his craft and how his skills and how much he wanted to challenge himself evolved. Would you say that you also get better at solving these puzzles, or do you start from scratch each time?
So I don't know if I've gotten better at puzzles in recent years, but I feel like there's definitely a learning curve when at least you first start doing jigsaw puzzles, like knowing that it's easy to start with the corners or with the edges and grouping pieces together by color or object represented.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I'm not starting from scratch, but at the same time, I don't know that I have any like elite strategies for puzzling either. Do you think that you are good at puzzles?
Again, I don't do the jigsaws, but on crosswords, I'm very excited to go back to Britain because there, you know, there they have those. I mean, I'm sure they have them here too, but they're the cryptic puzzles, and those are ones where you just have to be in the swing of it because there's really just a whole bunch of like there's maybe 5 to 10 you know, types of things that you need to know to answer them, and you forget, right? At the moments, I'll probably only be aware of anagrams, but after about 5 days, or maybe more like 5 weeks, I'll be more used to that kind of cluing. So mm-hmm. I just think generally I'm not necessarily, you know, totally gifted, but like most things, you know, practice improves performance. I think maybe I could become a self-help YouTube person saying Ooh. Things like that. Yeah, I'm going to go do that. All right. I was struck by what Lennon said about how the art that he was consuming, the things that he surrounded himself with, basically affected what he was making in his day job. You know, clearly that's one of the few things that creative people can manipulate when they want to, you know, get into a vibe or whatever. We often talk on this show about creating playlists that will put you in the mood that suits a particular project, for example. I'm curious if there are things you do when you want to establish a certain mood or to change the style of the work you've been producing.
So I think I fall into the music pool as well. Like, I think like building a playlist or finding specific musical artists or albums is a really big thing that you can do to help yourself kind of be stimulated in that way. And the important thing, I think, is that music is something you can listen to while you're still working. Whereas if you were watching a TV show or a movie for inspiration, that does require like a separate dedicated time for it. Yeah. Do you have any tips or hacks like this?
No, and I'm still looking because I want that thing, you know? I want that. I don't work well with music or like music that I know. I've actually had some benefits of listening to just kind of Brain FM, which is like mm-hmm. music, I guess, that they manipulate to help you concentrate or whatever. But I'm wondering if I should like put some photos around where I work or things like that. But I haven't really found that. So listeners, if you have any tips for things that we can do or specifically that I can do, send us an email at working@slate.com. Well, that's all the time we have for this week, unless, of course, you're a Slate Plus subscriber, in which case you will soon hear a little something extra from this week's interview. Not only that, I just want to remind you that if you join Slate Plus, you'll get extra segments of some Slate shows, entire bonus episodes of shows like Slow Burn and Big Mood, Little Mood, and you will never hit a paywall on the Slate site. You can learn more by visiting slate.com/workingplus.
Thank you to our guest, Lennon Aksumit, and thanks to our wonderful and not at all puzzling, except in a good way, producer Cameron Drews. We'll be back next week for my interview with Dia Sundurga's principal perfumer and brand designer, David Seth and Kavi Moltz. Until then, get back to work.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.